Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Harbaugh. First on this week's program, the cover story from the print edition of the New Times. Stopped on a bike, killed by a Phoenix cop, inside a family's grief. It was written by T.J. LeHeru and was posted on the Phoenix New Times website on June 11th. Maria Alvarez's home was abuzz with activity. Generations of family members milled around the front yard of her Guadalupe house one breezy February day, drinking sodas and picking at a Little Caesar's pizza on a folding table. In the driveway, toddlers rollicked, driving miniature electric cars and intermittently howling. These were Maria's great-grandchildren, and whenever they got out of hand, the 73-year-old reined them in with a great-grandmotherly admonishment. "Go talk to Tata Sergio," she said in a stern but loving voice. "He don't like you behaving that way." The Tata in question was Maria's son, and he wasn't there, at least not physically. But Sergio Alvarez's presence hung over the gathering. Maria had directed the rambunctious tots to two nearby poster boards, each plastered with photos of Sergio over the years. More were to be found on the table, in photo books and journals documenting his life. Sergio's premature death left the Alvarez family, including his six children, with countless questions about his demise. On May 28, 2004, roughly 9 months before the get-together in Guadalupe, a Phoenix police officer had shot and killed Sergio in a late-night encounter that remains shrouded in mystery. Publicly, police said they had stopped Alvarez over a bicycle light infraction. But police records show police used the bike light as a pretext to stop Alvarez because he was riding his bike near, quote, a drug house. The stop ended with three bullets tearing through the 48-year-old's body. In between, police said Sergio managed to shoot an officer despite being pinned to the ground by two cops. How that happened is not clear. The body-worn cameras carried by both cops fell off during the encounter. As a result, footage of the incident released by the department captures almost nothing, just audio from the struggle. The department's video briefing does not include footage indicating how the stop escalated. Now, a full year after Sergio's death, his loved ones remain tormented by all they don't know about his final hour. Reports and records they've obtained from the police provide few satisfying answers. The one snippet of his final moments that the family has actually recovered, nearby security camera footage from after the shooting, which shows officers kicking the thrice-shot Alvarez and waiting several minutes to render life-saving aid, has only sharpened the family's grief. Because the police narrative is that Sergio shot first, his family members said, lawyers have declined to help them build a case against the department. Instead, like so many families who have lost loved ones to the Phoenix cops and their service weapons, and there are an alarming number of them, they are left mostly with the weight of their unimaginable loss, an open wound that might never fully close. I don't know why. They could have just hit him in the leg or the arm, Maria cried, holding back tears and thinking of the rowdy children in the driveway. He's missing his grandbabies. He should be here. Checkered past, new start. The bicycle Sergio was riding that night was a common and welcome sight around Guadalupe, a town south of Phoenix, of 5,000 predominantly Latino and Yaqui residents. Just like Norteño music and the starch-white Our Lady of Guadalupe Catholic Church, Sergio and his bike were a fixture of the dry, dusty community where the median household income is about 25% lower than that of Phoenix. He used to cruise around with his bike back and forth, said Jose Tavena, who lives down the street from Maria. He would come over and pull over and say hello to everybody, shake everybody's hands. A calm, large man with a soothing baritone voice, Tavena has been in the neighborhood long enough to remember Sergio's childhood. As a kid, Sergio was charged up with energy, playing baseball and running around town. As an adult, Tavena and others said, Sergio was thoughtful and eager to please. A neighborhood stroll with Sergio could take ages. There were so many people he stopped to greet. It'd take a long time to get down the street, said Chrissy Gutierrez, Sergio's high school sweetheart and the mother of his children. Frequently, he'd offer more than just a hello. He'd say, you guys need some more beer? And would go to the store and bring a 12-pack, Tavena said. Sometimes he would bring meat or steaks for us to grill. Rene Alvarez, who married into the family and lives in Guadalupe, said Sergio would always make sure somebody had something before he did, even somebody that would be lying in the street. I'd see him go to the store, buy him some food, and make sure he's up. Generous and kind as he was, Sergio had his own struggles, his 28-year-old daughter Destiny said. His run-in with the cops last year was hardly his first. Court documents from a 2015 case note that Alvarez had been arrested at least 8 times, most often for marijuana possession and resisting arrest. In 2010, he and Chrissy got in a heated argument that led to a 911 call for a domestic violence incident, though Chrissy told officers he had not harmed her. Alvarez fled the house and threw a bag of weed on the roof, which officers found. He was ultimately sentenced to a year in prison for the drugs. In 2015, Sergio was charged with trespassing and aggravated assault for allegedly beating up a woman, landing probation and paying restitution. A year later, he was booked for a DUI while driving a child younger than 15. He pleaded guilty and was sentenced to more than 3.5 years in prison. The DUI was Sergio's last run-in with the law before his death. Since he was released early in 2019, he had been motivated to stay out of trouble and do everything right for us, Destiny said. Prison and the separation from his family had been rough. He did not want to go back, Destiny said. After he got out, she noticed a change in her father's demeanor. He was just present. He'd take the time to know where we were mentally and emotionally, and where we wanted to be in life, Destiny said. He asked a lot of questions that made me know he was working to be a better person. Sergio was interested in Yaqui mythology and believed in a higher power. He talked about starting a YouTube channel to share his life experiences. Destiny and her 25-year-old sister, Isla, remember that her father was always laughing and eating, especially eating. Sergio's appetite was so ravenous that his grandchildren started calling him Tata Chicken. Sergio would laugh at the moniker and then take his grandkids to get some chicken. His post-relief life was hardly carefree, of course. After his release, Sergio worked for 4 years at a construction company and then at a Tempe manufacturer, Cox Reels, but he had been out of work for about a year before his death, Destiny said. He mainly helped Maria around the house. Outside of it, he felt constantly harassed by police, and his own history with law enforcement plagued his thoughts. It looked like they always picked on him, said Renee. He didn't do nothing, but he would get mad and ask, "Why are you following me?" There's no indication that the Phoenix cops who stopped Sergio on his bike had any knowledge of his criminal history. But his sour history with the police may have been on Sergio's mind. Though the body cam footage of his fateful encounter with Phoenix officers doesn't reveal much, Sergio can be heard asking for one thing over and over. Help. Playing a hunch. In the early morning hours of his last day on Earth, Sergio was biking to the house where two of his kids, Isla and Sergio Jr., lived in Phoenix, Destiny said. According to a police report, he was wearing a red shirt with Al Pacino as Scarface on the front. Phoenix police officers Peter De La Pena and Andrew Estrella stopped him near Southern Avenue and 10th Street, allegedly because his bike was missing a required light. However, the police report reveals that both officers told a detective investigating the shooting that they knew a few drug houses in the area, and Alvarez did not have a bike light on, so they decided to stop and talk to him. A pretextual stop is one in which a police officer identifies an objective violation of a traffic law. The officer may lawfully stop a motorist, even if the officer's actual intention is to use the stop to investigate a hunch that, by itself, would not amount to reasonable suspicion or probable cause, as the Stanford Law Review wrote in 2021. They were ruled constitutional by the Supreme Court in 1996, though there have been many efforts in states to ban or limit them in the decades since. Studies have shown that the police conduct pretextual stops of racial minorities, which Sergio certainly was, at a disproportionate rate. The two officers spoke to Sergio through a window of their Chevy Tahoe, the police report said. They asked his name. De La Pena told an investigator that Alvarez provided a name of Sergio something, which De La Pena incorrectly assumed to be a fake name, in part based on what they perceived to be Sergio's shiftiness and unwillingness to identify himself. The two officers exited their vehicle and told Sergio they were stopping him for the bike light infraction. At least, that's what the police report says. If the two officers did in fact tell Sergio the reason for the stop, it's not evident in the body cam footage released by the department as part of a critical incident briefing after his killing. The video starts in the heat of action, with Estrella rushing out of the driver's side of the Tahoe to the opposite side, where De La Pena could be seen pushing Sergio up against the car. When the audio begins playing after a delay, Sergio can be heard screaming. "What are you guys doing?" Sergio asked, only to be told that he's under arrest and to get on the ground. "For what? I haven't done shit to you guys," Sergio said. "Do I have a warrant or what the fuck?" The officers did not reply. The rest of what happened is barely visible. Police said one officer lost his body camera at the point and start of the interaction, while the other lost his when Sergio was wrestled to the ground. From that point, all that can be seen is a jostle of bodies in one corner of the frame. After the shooting, both officers told investigators that Estrella was on top of a face-down Sergio, while De La Pena was wrestling with Sergio's right hand. Though not much can be seen in the body cam footage, much can be heard. Sergio continued screaming for help and told the officers to get off of him and stop choking him. "I'm not," one officer replied. "Stop grabbing my hand." "I can't breathe," Sergio said, his voice muffled. Then, about 80 seconds after the body cam footage began, right after Sergio shifted his weight onto one hip, Estrella told investigators a shot was fired. Speaking to an investigator from the hospital after the shooting, Estrella said it sounded like a balloon loudly popping. "He shot me," Estrella said twice. Speaking to investigators afterward, De La Pena said he saw a gun in Sergio's left hand, which Estrella said earlier had been extended and empty above his body. "Put it down," De La Pena ordered. "Put it down now." De La Pena ordered Estrella to step back and radio for assistance. Then, he told investigators, he put the muzzle of his service weapon to Sergio's back and fired. De La Pena said he fired two shots, though the medical examiner's report said he was shot three times in the shoulder, jaw, and neck. "Stop, or I'm going to shoot you again," De La Pena commanded. Sergio continued to moan and scream. At the end of the video provided by police, he again asked officers, "Why did you stop me?" The officers did not reply. The shooting and the aftermath. Exactly what happened in that roughly 2 minute span may never be fully known, at least outside of the official police narrative. Did Sergio really manage to pull out a handgun and fire it while being dogpiled by two cops? If he did, why? The record leaves only the recollections of De La Pena and Estrella. Phoenix New Time requested all body cam footage from the incident, but was not provided any footage that showed how the interaction between Sergio and the two officers began. Sergio's family has filled in one gap, although hardly to their satisfaction. In both an advisory issued soon after Sergio's death and in the video published 2 weeks later, police said Sergio was able to stand up and walk away from the officers before being taken into custody, at which point he was given emergency medical aid. But that brief narrative glosses over much of what happened after Sergio was shot. Records indicate that De La Pena was busy trying to give aid to Estrella and let Sergio walk away because he had dropped the gun and knew other officers were responding. Security camera footage from a nearby building, obtained by Sergio's family, shows much of what happened next. Though police sometimes include such footage in critical incident briefings, it was not included in the public briefing on Sergio's death. The department claimed it had no surveillance footage related to the incident in response to a records request from New Times. The footage shows that Sergio stumbled away after he was shot. He appeared to be in a stupor. When a squad car pulled up, he raised his arms. No weapon was visible in his hands, just a cell phone. According to the police report, Sergeant Brett McElvain walked over and sent Sergio to the ground with a forceful kick. McElvain told investigators that he activated his body camera while driving up, though no footage from it was included in the department's public briefing. The department said it is still working on producing that footage in response to New Times Records request. Two more cops joined McElvain, kicking and pummeling Sergio for about 30 seconds before ultimately handcuffing him. Then, for roughly 7 to 10 minutes, it is difficult to tell, based on the grainy security camera footage, three or four officers stood over Sergio's squirming body. One officer told investigators that he quickly started rendering aid to Sergio by stuffing his gunshot wounds, though it's difficult to tell from the surveillance footage exactly what happened. As time passed, more officers arrived on the scene, walking around the car-swarmed street. After a few minutes, Alvarez's body stopped moving. At that point, the footage shows an officer performing CPR on Sergio for about a minute before paramedics arrived. According to hospital records signed by doctors at Valleywise Health Medical Center, Alvarez likely died at 3:24 a.m., roughly 3 minutes after the ambulance left the scene. He was pronounced dead at 3:42 a.m., shortly after arriving at the hospital. Police files say police recovered two guns, one that was left on the ground by the bicycle, missing one bullet, and another in Alvarez's backpack. They also found two magazines of ammunition, a small baggie of a clear substance that they believed to be methamphetamine, and a bag of blue pills they thought were fentanyl. New Times sent questions to the department about whether that bullet that hit Estrella matched the bullets in the gun recovered on scene, and if any fingerprints on the weapon matched Sergio's. New Times also asked if the substances found in Sergio's bag were what police suspected. Donna Rossi, the department's director of communications, declined to answer. New Times also asked the police department for the results of its internal investigation into the shooting, but has not received them. Records show the Maricopa County Attorney's Office declined to bring charges against De La Pena for shooting Alvarez, but the office noted that no other officers involved were investigated. Destiny said that while the guns and ammo found on Sergio were not a surprise to the family, the drugs were. "I knew about the guns," she said. "He used to do drugs before he got out of prison the last time, but it didn't seem like he was using them. We didn't know anything about him having them." The shooting isn't the only thing that troubles the Alvarez family. Sergio's daughters are disgusted by what happened after. "Instead of helping him, they're kicking him," Destiny said. Isla called the police response fucked up and unnecessary. "They were beating him while he was already down," she said, "and already shot." The Alvarez family learned of Sergio's death at 9 a.m. later that morning, when a Phoenix police officer rolled up to the house of Sergio's sister, named Maria, like their mother. According to the police report, the cop was accompanied by Maricopa County Sheriff's deputies due to anti-police sentiment known to the deputies from the suspect's family. Nothing aggressive happens in an audio recording of the encounter released by police, which lasts about 7 minutes, but it makes for difficult listening. The younger Maria answers the door brightly, making pleasant chatter with the officer. Eventually, the officer apparently shows her a photo of Sergio. "Is that your brother?" he asks. "Yes," Maria responds. "I'm sorry," the officer says. "He's passed away." "No," Maria says. "How?" As the officer explains the circumstances of Sergio's death, Maria breaks down crying. Gasping for breath, she asks a few questions. Where to identify Sergio's body? Where he was killed? The officer asks if there's anyone she needs to call. As she sobs, he offers his card. "I wish this had never happened," he says. Questions remain. More than a year has passed since then, and that shock and grief persist. Sergio's mother has refused to watch the police videos documenting the death of her son. Renee has watched them and called the footage disgusting. Isla is suspicious about the beginning of the interaction between her father and the officers. "You can tell what their intentions were, and that's why he yelled the way he did," she said. Skepticism of law enforcement is typical in Guadalupe. The Maricopa County Sheriff's Office patrols the community, which was the focus of many unconstitutional immigration sweeps under former Sheriff Joe Arpaio. The Sheriff's Office has been under court-ordered oversight since 2013, and by the end of the year, will have spent more than $300 million bringing the agency into compliance with a federal judge's orders, much of it spent working to clear a backlog of internal affairs complaints and to correct a pattern of racial profiling in traffic stops. "They haven't just done it to him," Renee said. "There's a lot going on with these cops." The Phoenix Police Department is a separate entity, of course, but is just as pockmarked. A recent study showed that Phoenix cops have killed 173 people since 2013, the second highest death toll of any department in the country. Between 2008 and 2018, Phoenix approved $26 million in settlement money for police violence in 191 cases. In November 2023, the city paid $5.5 million to the family of Ali Osman, who was killed after throwing rocks at an officer during a mental health crisis in September 2022. Just weeks after Sergio was gunned down, the U.S. Department of Justice released a 126-page report that found that Phoenix police regularly committed a litany of civil rights violations, including discriminating against people of color and using excessive and unnecessary deadly force. Notably, given how police responded after shooting Sergio, the DOJ also found that officers unreasonably delay rendering aid to people they have shot, and at times use significant, unreasonable force against people who are already incapacitated, sometimes even unconscious, as the result of police gunfire. While questions remain about the justification for shooting Sergio, what's clear is that his family has felt left in the dark after his death. Destiny said the Alvarez family paid more than $2,500, a substantial sum for the family, to get public records and video footage related to his killing. Most of it still has not been released to them, they say. Destiny said the family finally got Sergio's phone from police in the spring, which they believe their father might have used to record after walking away from officers. But Destiny said the phone was wiped of most of its content when they received it. It had no pictures and no history of messages. Officer Wesley Thompson, one of the cops who responded to the shooting scene, noted in the incident report that he kept the phone charging so police could have the option of extracting its contents as evidence. The statute of limitations for a wrongful death suit in Arizona is 2 years, so the Alvarez family still has time to find answers and pursue a case. But while other victims of police violence have mounted successful civil claims against the city, that appears to be a dead end for the Alvarezes. Destiny said several attorneys, including Bob McWhorter, who has represented many clients and families in police misconduct lawsuits, have turned down their case because police alleged Alvarez shot first. Reached by phone, McWhorter confirmed that he declined to take the Alvarez family's case after viewing news reports that recounted the police narrative that Alvarez shot Estrella. I can tell you that I did a preliminary review of the case and decided not to take it, McWhorter said. Without someone to shepherd them through the process, where to get information, how to apply pressure to those who have it, the Alvarez family feels stuck. Every day is tainted by Sergio's absence. Destiny still speaks to him, as if he were still here. Sergio was always playing music, and Isla has noticed how silent the house is without him. Every time my dad would smile, it would light up the room, she said. When he passed, it felt so much quieter. Sergio's death has probably been hardest on his mother. She's the mayor of the neighborhood, as her neighbor describes her, a woman who worked at a community nonprofit for 16 years. She helped elderly people clean their homes and held back to school drives. She assisted people with traffic tickets, kept the local cemetery tidy, and cared for street dogs. But that cool February day at her home, just a few days before what would have been Sergio's 49th birthday, Maria looked gut-punched. As she gazed on each picture of her son adorning the poster boards in front of the house, her face vacillated between heartbreak and joy. "Oh my God, mijo," she mumbled, a crackle of desperation in her voice. Holding one of her great-granddaughters, tears filled her eyes as she recounted one last memory. "He'd come in the morning, and I could hear his music," Maria said. "He'd find me and give me a big kiss and pick me up, ask me, 'Mom, what do you want? Let me go buy you a burrito,' and he'd be off." Remember that if you miss any of the stories in this program, or any other SunSounds program, you can listen to them on demand. Just go to sunsounds.org and click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then click on On Demand Podcasts. Scroll down to the program you're interested in and click on Listen. MAGA County Recorder throws a fit, sues Board of Supervisors. This next story was written by Zach Buchanan and was posted on June 13th. Editor's note, this story was updated on June 13th to include the contents of a cease and desist letter sent by Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell to the lawyer who claims to be representing Justin Heap, the county recorder. After months of back-and-forth intra-Republican Party sniping, the two entities in charge of running elections in Maricopa County are heading to court. On Thursday, MAGA election skeptic and Maricopa County recorder Justin Heap announced he was suing the County Board of Supervisors, which he accused of gaslighting the public and denying him the ability to perform his statutory duties. The lawsuit, filed in Maricopa County Superior Court, claims the Republican-controlled board is engaged in an unlawful attempt to seize near-total control over the administration of elections by not providing the necessary funds Heap says he needs to perform his duties and by absorbing the Recorder's Information Technology Department into the county's IT department. The lawsuit asks a judge to force the board to fund Heap's agency and to return IT personnel and systems so that they could be run independently again. From day one, I promised the voters of Maricopa County that I would deliver more secure, more honest, and more transparent elections for all voters, regardless of political party, Heap said in a media release. Similarly, I have promised to utilize every tool under state and federal law, including Arizona's judicial system, to accomplish these very popular objectives. In a press release, Maricopa County Board Chairman Thomas Galvin and Vice Chairman Kate Brophy McGee called Heap's lawsuit absurd, frivolous, and another example of Heap's irresponsible and juvenile ready-fire-aim approach to governance. From day one, Recorder Heap has been making promises that the law doesn't allow him to keep, Galvin wrote. Arizona election statutes delineate election administration between county boards of supervisors and recorders to ensure there are checks and balances, and Recorder Heap clearly doesn't understand the responsibilities of his position. Despite the heated rhetoric, the lawsuit seems to really be about a stalled negotiation. A former state lawmaker, Heap ran for recorder making big claims about fixing the county's laughingstock elections, often promising changes that had nothing to do with his office. In Arizona, county recorders handle voter registration, early balloting, and mail balloting, while the county elections department, which is overseen by a board of supervisors, counts ballots and handles election day voting. To run any election, both entities must work together. Heap seems unwilling, or maybe unable, to share the sandbox with the board, which has a 4-to-1 Republican slant and includes several members who share Heap's pro-Trump leanings. When Heap took office in January, he was steamed that his predecessor and the Board of Supervisors, many of whom had lost their elections, as Heap's lawsuit notes, had entered into a new shared services agreement that transferred some responsibilities from the recorder's office to the county elections department. Heap cast this as a lame duck betrayal. Upon taking office, he promptly canceled the agreement. For the past several months, Heap and the board have engaged in sometimes acrimonious negotiations. In February, Heap issued a fiery press release about the previous SSA, which was signed after then-recorder Stephen Richer and three board members knew that they'd be leaving office. Despite Heap's claims at the time, which he repeats in his lawsuit, the agreement was not cemented in secret. It was, in fact, the subject of numerous news stories. Heap also exaggerated the changes made in the agreement, which mostly amounted to centralizing the recorder's IT department and shifting the early ballot processing to the county elections department. Heap canceled the agreement and kept making bellicose statements about the board's unwillingness to negotiate a new one, casting himself as a defender of democracy among a pit of anti-democratic vipers. Richer and several members of the board, including Chairman Thomas Galvin and Debbie Lesko, the latter of whom is hardly anti-Trump, usually responded by pointing out the factual flaws in Heap's accounts. The board did so again in its press release Thursday afternoon. The two supervisors wrote that the lawsuit's claims about withheld funding and the inability to access IT functions were false. Brophy McGee wrote that Heap has been confrontational, inconsistent, and misleading in both public statements and private interactions, and has shown that his allegiance to himself dwarfs any duty that he feels toward Maricopa County voters and taxpayers. Why can't we be friends? The MAGA recorder has managed to make even more enemies in his own party since canceling the SSA. When his office claimed that the Maricopa County Attorney's Office had consulted on issues related to the SSA, Republican County Attorney Rachel Mitchell publicly called that bullshit. And when Heap's Chief of Staff, Sam Stone, suggested last month that the county mail ballots for a special election to some voters who did not request them, which is illegal, Arizona Republican Party Chairperson Gina Swoboda joined the pile-on. Speaking to Phoenix New Times at the time, Swoboda wondered how someone who ran on election integrity can think that's a good idea, and threatened to sue Heap if he pursued the idea. New Times reached out to Richer, who spent 4 years in the office fending off election misinformation before losing to Heap in the Republican primary. After glancing through the 58-page lawsuit, Richer said it contained quite a few racial inaccuracies. He also noted that it was filed by outside counsel, specifically by America First Legal, which he understood to be prohibited. I was always told that I could not receive legal counsel outside of the Maricopa County Attorney's Office or MCAO appointed counsel, Richard wrote in the email. Recorder Heap seems to have violated that rule. Galvin and Brophy McGee harped on that rule in their first press release, which noted that America First Legal may not have been authorized to file a suit on behalf of Heap or his office by the county attorney, which runs counter to state statute. Indeed, the Arizona Supreme Court ruled in the 1978 case Board of Supervisors of Maricopa County v. Woodall that county officers, in that particular case, the Board of Supervisors, could not hire in-house counsel independent of the county attorney for the purpose of advising it. Heap securing outside representation may result in serious legal consequences, Galvin and Brophy McGee's release noted, because board members expect the county attorney to assert her lawful authority and not permit the recorder to usurp her statutory powers in this instance. Indeed, in a Friday letter to James Rogers of America First Legal that was obtained by VoteBeat, Mitchell forcefully asserted that Arizona law makes her the attorney for Heap's office and demanded that Rogers cease and desist from any further representation of the recorder. Mitchell also demanded that Rogers withdraw the lawsuit and threatened to report him to the State Bar of Arizona if he continued communicating with Heap's office on the matter. Neither I nor the Board of Supervisors authorized you or America First Legal Foundation to represent Recorder Heap, Mitchell wrote. As a result, neither you nor America First Legal Foundation represents him. More broadly, though, Richer questioned the strategy of taking on such an antagonistic stance with the board. I also don't see the wisdom in filing a lawsuit against the body that ultimately sets the budget for your office, Richer wrote. Have fun asking for future raises for your employees. Additionally, the split nature of election administration requires recorders and boards of supervisors to work together, a cause Heap's lawsuit won't help. Richer has advocated for changing that sometimes adversarial arrangement, specifically by making county recorder an appointed position under the board's purview. But until that happens, everybody's got to play nice. Owing to the asinine statutory framework of Arizona's elections, the board and the recorder have to get along at least somewhat in order to effectively administer elections in Maricopa County, Richard wrote. I managed that during my 4 years. My predecessor, Adrian Fontes, managed that during his 4 years. I've seen Chairman Galvin, Supervisor Lesko, and the others try to work with Recorder Heap to try to make that happen for these next 4 years. Heap hasn't, running in the complete opposite direction of the cooperation. Can he turn things around? After filing this lawsuit, Richard said, I don't see how that's possible. Guy who pushed voting fraud bullshit, indicted for fake petition signatures. Caitlin Sievers of the Arizona Mirror wrote this next story, and it was posted on the Phoenix New Times website on June 10th. Former Republican state legislator Austin Smith has been indicted on 14 misdemeanor and felony counts for allegedly forging voter signatures on his petitions for re-election last year. A former member of the state legislature's far-right Arizona Freedom Caucus, Smith dropped his re-election bid last spring after he was accused of personally forging more than 100 petition signatures to get on the 2024 Republican primary ballot. Around the same time, Smith resigned from his position as senior director at Turning Point Action, the political advocacy arm of Turning Point USA, a far-right organization based in Phoenix that aims to mobilize young conservatives. But according to Smith's LinkedIn and X accounts, he was rehired in January as Turning Point Action's strategic director. Smith made his X account private, blocking his biographical information, including his job title, on the morning of June 10th, after the news of his indictment was made public. A Maricopa County grand jury indicted Smith on June 2nd on 4 felony counts for presenting documents he knew were forged to the Arizona Secretary of State's office and 10 misdemeanor counts for personally forging the names of electors on his re-election petitions. The felonies each come with a 1 to 2 year prison sentence. The misdemeanors come with a 6 month imprisonment. When the allegations of signature fraud became public in April 2024, Smith vehemently denied them, calling them ludicrous and accusing Democrats of creating a coordinated attack against him. However, 100 of the signatures on his petition to get on last year's Republican primary ballot, along with corresponding addresses, obviously looked like they were all written by the same person. And some of the people whose names were on the petition told the court that they never signed it. Smith took no accountability for the allegedly fraudulent signatures and said that he dropped out of the race because he didn't want to spend tens of thousands of dollars defending himself in the civil elections challenge, as well as a possible criminal case for forgery. Election denial. Ironically, Smith was a member of the Arizona House of Representatives Municipal Oversight and Elections Committee, where he decried unproven election frauds in Maricopa County, and has even made jokes accusing county officials of mail-in ballot signature fraud on social media. Signature verification in Maricopa County is a joke, Smith wrote on Twitter in May 2023. Smith was one of the many Arizona Republicans who falsely claimed without evidence that the 2020 presidential election was stolen from President Donald Trump. What happened on May 3, 2020 in Maricopa County continues to be a national disgrace and embarrassment, Smith wrote on his website. Not only that, Austin believes it was criminal and will fight every day in the state legislature to hold those responsible to account, Austin wrote about himself in third person. Multiple audits, including a highly partisan review orchestrated by Arizona Senate Republicans, found no discrepancies in the election, Fraud allegations made in court in the days and weeks following the 2020 election were all rejected because there was no evidence backing up the claims. Neither Turning Point USA Action nor Smith immediately responded to a request for comment. Next, a story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on June 10th. Trump going after funding to help vulnerable Arizonans afford lawyers. A mother seeking to keep her kids away from her soon-to-be ex-husband, who led police on a high-speed chase with their children in the car. A grandmother who is facing eviction after she stopped paying rent because her landlord refused to fix her broken air conditioning. A veteran who was kicked off Medicaid after an online scammer stole his identity. All of these people have one thing in common. They need a lawyer, but they can't afford one. To navigate Arizona's complicated legal system, to gain full custody of their kids, to stay in their home, to restore access to their health insurance, they will turn to one of three Arizona nonprofits that provide legal aid. Every year, a small army of attorneys, caseworkers, and volunteers helps roughly 24,000 low-income Arizonans steer through a crisis. They provide legal representation in eviction cases, help domestic violence victims obtain protection orders, and assist the victims of countless scams. Basically, when something goes wrong and you don't have the money for an attorney, Arizona's civil legal aid system is there to help. That safety net is hardly as robust as it should be. Arizona's three civil legal aid groups, Community Legal Services, DNA People's Legal Services, and Southern Arizona Legal Aid, can accept only about 50% of the cases they receive. But it catches a lot of people at risk of falling through the cracks. It's scary to imagine a world where we don't have the ability to provide these services, said Pam Bridge, the Director of Litigation and Advocacy for CLS. That scary world may be around the corner. As he has with so many programs that help people, President Donald Trump aims to end the federal program that funds much of the operation of Arizona's civil legal aid services. In late May, the Trump administration released its 2026 fiscal year budget proposal, which slashed the Federal Legal Services Corporation budget from $560 million to $21 million in order to administer an orderly closeout. LSC, which is a nonprofit established by Congress in 1974, was also a target of Trump's in his first term, although he wasn't able to shutter it then. This time, though, he may succeed. If he does, Arizona will be particularly ill-prepared. LSC allocates roughly $16.5 million to Arizona's three legal aid groups each year, making up the vast majority of their funding. Losing federal funds could effectively end the services that thousands of residents rely upon every year. Arizona is one of three states that spend no state money on civil legal aid. On average, a state civil legal aid system gets 19% of its funding from the federal government, but in Arizona, that number is 80%. We are largely dependent, almost entirely dependent, on federal funding to protect Arizonans' rights, said Chris Groninger, the chief strategy officer of the Arizona Bar Foundation, which provides a small portion of civil legal aid funding. Lawmakers and civil legal aid groups are now scrambling to avert the crisis that Trump seeks to foist upon them. They are batting around ideas and pushing for money in the state budget. At the center of that effort is an unlikely figure, Ann Scott Timmer, the Chief Justice of the very conservative Arizona Supreme Court. All hands on deck. A week before the Trump administration released its budget proposal, Timmer summoned a collection of stakeholders for an all-hands-on-deck meeting. At the meeting were judges, lawyers, lawmakers, legal aid representatives, and a staffer for Governor Katie Hobbs. The people who can do something about this, Timmer said. My goal, Timmer told Phoenix New Times, was to put it on their plate. The Arizona Supreme Court can't blatantly advocate or lobby for a policy. We can get people together in a nice room, Timmer said. We'll give you a cheap lunch, and there you go. But her involvement underscored the gravity of the problem. The fact that this was coming from the Supreme Court absolutely elevated this issue to me, the Democratic State Senator Annalise Ortiz said, who was at the meeting. It is rare that we see the Supreme Court kind of sounding the alarm on issues like this. The stakeholders largely agree about the magnitude of the issue. Arizona's civil legal aid system is already small. Other states fund civil legal aid through a direct state appropriation, a court filing fee, or both. Arizona does neither. The $16.5 million the state's three programs currently receive from LCS accounts for 60 to 70% of their collective budgets. Another 8 to 10% comes from other federal programs. The rest comes from the Arizona Bar Foundation and other grants. That money pays for fewer than 80 attorneys who provide civil legal aid to the entire state, Timmer said. More than a million low-income Arizonans are eligible for that aid, but the organizations that provide it can only handle about 9,000 cases a year. The system doesn't work perfectly for low-income Arizonans, said Drew Schaefer, the director of the nonprofit William E. Morris Institute for Justice. If they can't afford an attorney, they're essentially relying on civil legal aid to fix those problems when they can't afford to protect their basic health and safety. For Community Legal Services, whose flyers can be found in Phoenix courthouses, those legal aid services run the gamut. CLS helps domestic violence victims with protection orders and custody agreements. It helps seniors with their benefits. It aids victims of fraud, workers whose former employers have kept their personal property, and people dealing with wage garnishment and car repossession. Losing the main source of funding for civil legal aid would be definitely a code red emergency, Schaefer said, one that would mean essentially the end of our civil legal aid system as we know it. Groninger called it a shock to the system. We're not ready for this, he said. We're not prepared. One solution is obvious. The state of Arizona could pick up the slack that the federal government is eager to loosen. Indeed, one product of Timmer's all-hands meeting was a proposal to allocate $10 million in the next state budget to backfill these programs. But in Arizona, hammering out the budget is anything but simple. A budget solution? The budget proposed is the project of Ortiz and fellow Democratic State Senator Lauren Kuby, both of whom attended Timmer's meeting. Time is of the essence. By law, Arizona is supposed to hammer out a budget by June 30th for the next fiscal year. With a Democratic governor and a Republican-controlled legislature, that process can be very twisted and happen very quickly, Kuby said. Budget negotiations between Hobbs and Republican leadership generally occur behind closed doors. On Saturday, Republican State Senator T.J. Shope wrote in the Senate Republican Caucus newsletter that negotiations are in the final stages, and that he anticipates a proposal hitting Hobbs' desk within the next 2 weeks. Finding $10 million for civil legal aid would seem a drop in the bucket of the state's nearly $100 billion budget. However, Arizona is bracing for federal cuts across many programs, including public health grants and Medicaid. Meanwhile, many state Republicans would prefer to cut state programs, along with taxes, rather than fund more of them. That means we do not have a lot of extra money in our state budget to spend, Ortiz said. We are dealing with Republican leadership in the House and the Senate, who are not prioritizing the needs of working class people. Kuby believes the legislature could easily fund civil legal aid by reining in other costly programs, like the state's largely oversight-free school voucher system. Though, convincing the GOP to sign on to that is likely a pipe dream. It's unclear what Republican leadership thinks of the proposal to fund civil legal aid through the state. Arizona Senate President Warren Peterson and Arizona House Speaker Steve Montenegro did not respond to a request for comment. A lot of hopes and even more livelihoods may hang on that funding coming through. Schaefer called a $10 million budget infusion a modest incremental first step to avoid a complete catastrophe and disaster. Timmer told New Times that she'd love it if the state funded civil legal aid, though she, more than most, knows the policy decisions are the prerogatives of lawmakers. The Supreme Court's meeting accomplished one goal that I really wanted, she said, which was to put this on the radar screen of the people who can do something. In the meantime, legal aid organizations have no choice but to plow forward and hope that the money will be there in the end. We have to just keep going every day, Bridge said. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Please stay tuned for additional interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Joe Palmer.